everyone, welcome to this episode of Claims Never Sleep. I am your host, Megan Henry, and thank you so much for joining me. Again, this is a new launch of this podcast, so I appreciate everyone tuning in and seeing what it's all about. And I'm excited to bring in today's guest. Today, I have on Tim Donnelly, who is the VP of Casualty Claims, Senior Claims Counsel at Sompo International North America. And Tim handles both excess and first-party property claims. And he and I had a long talk before he came on about reporting. And I know it's everyone's favorite topic, attorneys and claims. There's a lot of opinions about reporting. But as an attorney, I always want to hear what my clients want to see in the reporting, because it's so important that you're delivering the message the way that they're looking for. So Tim's here to talk about kind of what, in his view, he's looking for in reports, especially with when you're talking about excess claims and certain things that, you know, stand out to him when he's reading reports from attorneys. So with that, let's bring him in.
This is the Claims Never Sleep podcast, presented by Cruiser Mitchell, with your host, Megan Henry.
Morning, Tim. Welcome to this episode of Claims Never Sleep. I'm so happy to have you. How are you today?
I'm good, Megan. Thanks for having me. Very excited to be here.
I will say every guest I have is special, but you're extra special because this is like a new podcast. So you're one of my very first guests. So give yourself a pat on the back for being one of the inaugural guests on Claims Never Sleep.
It's groundbreaking. Very honored.
You're here to talk about a lot of things, but mostly specific to your role in handling excess claims and some of the nuances with excess claims. But before we dive into that, I want to talk about you so everyone gets to know you a little bit and who you are and how you got to where you are, because that's, I say it with every single guest I have on the show, I think everyone's path to where they are now is super interesting because it's different. It's different for everybody. And I love to hear it. And, you know, maybe my listeners don't love it as much as I do, but oh, well, too bad. So sad. I like to know what's going on with everybody. But you're a lawyer by trade. Did you grow up wanting to be a lawyer, or how did you make the decision to go to law school?
I'm the first in my family to enter the legal field. I kind of fell into it during college, just being at Fordham University, being within the business school, getting exposed to law classes, having internships at law firms during the city during my time there. That was my first exposure to the field of law and what practicing would look like. And I saw like-minded people to myself. I saw a fit there. So it was really a more natural progression that I ended up applying to law school. I wanted to stay in the New York area. I grew up on Long Island. I was lucky enough to get into Brooklyn Law School, spend my time there in Brooklyn Heights, and law clerked at an insurance defense firm, which was a precursor to the future for me. It really was, I'm sure a lot of people have kind of looked back and you could see the path in retrospect of how you got to where you got to. But at the time, it was really just seeing what came my way and taking opportunities and being lucky enough to grow up in the shadow of New York City and have internships and opportunities like that in schools like Brooklyn and Fordham that gave me that opportunity. So
yeah, I remember when I was applying to law school, Fordham Law and Brooklyn Law were two of my hot choices. Fordham, I remember I got the rejection letter so fast that I was like, did they even receive my application? It was like, they decided in transit, nope, not coming. Brooklyn, I did get into it. I did actually really consider going there because I love the location and I thought it was like a great opportunity location. And at that time, I really wanted to be in New York, and then I didn't end up there. But I shared that similar feeling that I wanted to be in that space. And maybe it was just because after graduation from college, like everyone wanted to be in New York. And maybe I felt like I was having FOMO and I wanted to be there too.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot here. I'm still here. I'm in the Manhattan office today. And this is where I work out of. And so I still get the benefit of experiencing the city most days of the week when I'm here.
Yeah. Good and bad.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Well, we're right across from the tree here. So most of the past couple of weeks has been the bad end of it. And just dodging tourists.
Yeah. I guess I say, oh, that's nice, but that's probably actually terrible.
Yes. No, it's not where you want to be at this time of year.
No. Oh man. I remember we went up a few years ago. I think we went up the day after Christmas and it was, I mean, one of those things you have to do. And the kids thought it was like great, but I remember being like, oh, this is just terrible.
You have to learn your way around the area this time of year. And then what streets have less people than others?
Yes. So you go to school and you graduate and you work in private practice for some time and you're doing mostly insurance defense.
So yeah, I was doing a mix of insurance coverage and professional liability, which was mostly insurance broker, you know. I was continuing to get exposure to the insurance industry and the carrier world. I still remember the first time a partner sat me down and walked me through a CGL policy. Little did I know how much of that language I would end up memorizing in the future. But I really enjoyed the coverage work. It was contract interpretation to me. I enjoyed contracts during law school. Getting to dive into the case law and seeing how different insurance provisions were interpreted over time and how that applied to real world situations. The other big thing that attracted me to the insurance world was just the variety of claims and litigation that you see. It's really, especially doing broker work and or coverage work, you're not limited to just seeing auto accidents or trip and falls. You get to see more complex situations. You get to see situations that have partial insurance coverage and more business commercial litigation, especially once you switch to the carrier side and you kind of step back from the day-to-day handling of the claims and looking at it from a bigger picture perspective. I really do enjoy seeing thousands of cases every year and really getting the big picture view of what's happening across the country in litigation and in trends and trying to manage that and work a best result for my company out of that.
So how did you come about leaving the private practice and getting into the claims arena?
There was a lot of work in the construction defect claims handling world starting maybe 10, 12 years ago. There was an explosion of claims in Southwest and Florida. Coverage was getting broader for those claims. And there was a lot of work to be done by handlers and by coverage attorneys. How occurrence was going to be defined, how property damage was going to be defined, how the exclusions applied to these claims. There were cottage industries coming up, risk transfer issues. It was really, I think, ripe for the involvement of a lot of attorney handlers. So I was part of a hiring wave at a major carrier that resulted in me being part of a great hire group around a lot of smart, motivated people who were insurance focused and we're working on trying to get our arms around this industry. So that was my first exposure to claims handling and the claims world. And I've been here ever since. In 2017, I joined Sampo. Sampo was expanding their construction practice. I'm currently head of the construction casualty group here. We handle primary and excess casualty claims, property damage, bodily injury, anything really that comes out of a construction site. Most of our work is across the US, a lot of building in Florida still. A lot of building in California, Illinois, Massachusetts. But what I really like about my group is we handle claims, a lot of wrap-up claims and a lot of claims that are from the beginning of construction through the completed operations phase. So we really get to know project from the beginning and work with the insureds and the contractors throughout the life of the project, develop relationships with them, and really get to see a variety of different exposure and risk that comes out of this, which I think is very beneficial to our underwriting groups here at Sampo. I think that we pride ourselves on the feedback that we give to them and the trends and the experience we have in the construction industry, but also to the insureds as well, in terms of being able to communicate with them about different aspects of the project, different claims at different time periods, having resources available for them, considering that we have the same group handling the claims, regardless of whether it's a construction defect claim 5 years after completion of the project or a trip and fall on day one of the project. It's the same people that are handling the claim. So,
and also that's important too, because you really develop a true understanding of that insured business and their projects. And you kind of can anticipate potential risks and guide them along to avoid or mitigate those risks ahead of time before they become an issue.
Even on a more granular level, like we sometimes during a construction defect claim, we'll know the name of a project manager who was in charge of a specific scope of work because we worked with him on another claim. And so we can tell defense counsel, this is the person you need to talk to because he was involved on this claim with regard to this scope of work. And I think it's a good model and we've had success with it. So I really like working that way. I think the wrap-ups are a great product. They are something that allows us to forego some of the usual risk transfer contractual indemnity battles that occur between contractors and take a more unified approach to third-party liability. It's something that when it works really well. And our group is very experienced in handling those claims. So that's been great for us.
And when you say the wrap-ups, not everyone listening might be familiar with what exactly that means.
So a lot of, especially high-rise construction condominiums, commercial towers, are insured through owner-controlled or contractor-controlled insurance programs, also known as wrap-ups. Basically, all the contractors share liability insurance, yeah, and there's no need to tender additional insured claims amongst each other or tender contractual indemnity. It's the same insurance program, regardless of whether the electrical contractor or the plumbing contractor is liable for the loss. It's going up the same tower. It allows general contractors and owners to be sure of the liability insurance that's in place because they know what the terms are, what the exclusions are. And it allows claims to be handled in an expeditious manner in terms of, again, not having to spend time pointing fingers at each other and really get down to just adjusting the damages and liability for the claim.
Yeah, and the finger pointing can be lengthy and costly and hold up resolution of a third party claim because the deck actions alone with that can take forever.
Oh, absolutely. It's actually sometimes, and you'll appreciate this on the defense side, we come across plaintiff attorneys who are not used to these products at times, and they will sue numerous contractors because their goal is to trigger as many insurance policies as possible. And they want the finger pointing. They want the infighting. Yeah. They want us to essentially prosecute their claim for them. And they want a general contractor to expose a subcontractor's liability for an injury. It's somewhat amusing sometimes when one attorney shows up for 20 contractors that were named and says, I'm representing all of them. And to see that that tactic may not work under a wrap-up program, because it is just one policy. There's going to be no finger pointing. And we really just want to get down to the facts of what happened and find resolution of the claim. But we're not going to spend time throwing mud at each other to the benefit of plaintiff's counsel.
I love that too, because it is distracting. And as often in cases, as much as you can like talk to the other attorneys, be like, hey, let's have a unified front. And they were like, yeah, let's have a unified front. And then fast forward 3 months down the road, there's no unified front anymore. it's every person for themselves when you get to that mediation. And then shockingly, it doesn't resolve. So that tactic definitely works. Having that wrap-up program and having everyone kind of truly being a unified front takes away a lot of those distractions.
Yeah, absolutely. That's something that we really, and we endeavor to ensure that our claims handling and our practices here maximize the efficiency of that, that we don't lose sight of that in terms of this is what the strength of the program is. So let's leverage that towards a better result.
Yeah. Let me back up though for a second, because this is something I'm always interested in hearing too. Going from, you weren't in private practice a terribly long time, but it is still an adjustment. So how was that adjustment going from private practice over into the carrier side? Because one thing that when I've talked to people, one of the things that they've commented on is it's a hard mindset change, because when you're in private practice, you're a bill generator, you know, you pay for yourself. And then suddenly now you're moving to the carrier side and you're like, oh, it's hard to shift away from being like, okay, I put X amount on the board, like I'm good today. And it's a hard mind shift change. So how was that for you?
I don't miss billing time.
I'm sure you don't.
But yes, old habits die hard sometimes. It did take some time to get a sense of what a quality day would be in terms of pendings are large at large carriers. Mm-hmm. So it can get overwhelming, especially to somebody stepping into a claims handling role, to look at 150 lawsuits on your desk and not want to be proactive on every single one every single day. So getting into the rhythm of setting diaries, knowing which cases need attention at which time, knowing how much attention to give them. I'm sure the defense attorneys definitely appreciate it because it's billable time, but claims handlers can schedule conference calls every day if they want to go over different aspects of the case and brainstorm. So it's not like there's not work that you can do. There's always work that you can do. There's always strategizing and discussion that can be had. There's investigation that can be done. So there's definitely adjustment into getting the right rhythm and finding the right partners to work with externally that work on the same wavelength as you to know that your files are in good shape and that you're doing what needs to be done to protect the insured and also to maximize resolution opportunities. So yeah, there's definitely an adjustment. I think that there's also a lot of education in terms of how a carrier works and how internal business partners are structured, what that looks like, what they expect out of claims, how to communicate, most importantly, with internal business partners, especially as an attorney and within a claims organization, you have your own language, you've seen a lot. you've seen a lot of claims, you've seen a lot of trials, settlements, et cetera. So there's an innate sense that has to be communicated more intentionally when you're communicating that to actuaries or underwriters. They don't have the same knowledge base that claims or lawyers have. So they may not understand the distinction between negligence and gross negligence if you just casually mention it. It's something that you need to make sure that you're paying attention to and you're understanding who you're communicating with. So that absolutely is a learning process that you go through at the carrier.
Yeah. I imagine probably some trial and error too. I'm sure you may have learned almost the hard way that an underwriter might not know the difference between negligence and gross negligence, because you might just presume that they know. And then you find out later, oh, I was talking the talk, and they were being polite and nodding. Because like, look, don't we all like suffer from that? No one wants to say, oh, I don't understand what you're talking about. You're like, okay, yeah, I'll figure that out. Yep.
Yeah.
Totally get it.
Well, and you know what? This is something that I see it all the time. And I saw this when I was at the firm too. It's really a matter of coming up for air when you're working on a case, and it can happen whether you're on the carrier side or whether you're the primary defense attorney on a file. You get so acquainted with the parties involved, the fundamental facts, like what happened, who the big players are, who the small players are. When you're briefing somebody new on that case, some things you don't even realize that you're skimming over, because to you, it's that contractor's involvement in this claim was settled long ago, but to somebody new, it's, oh, wait, there's another party who might be at fault here.
Yep.
Let's spend 10 minutes talking about why they're not at fault. And it's, no, we maybe it's as simple as we confirmed they weren't even there that day. That was done years ago. But if they're on the caption still of the lawsuit and somebody sees them there, you have to be prepared to address that question. And so I think this is kind of going to go into a little bit about what we talk about later, but it's really getting that perspective and getting yourself, stepping out of the case for a second yourself and looking at it from the perspective of, if I didn't know anything about this case, what would I need to know? And what immediate questions would I have? And being prepared to answer those questions.
But with that, I think we should just segue right into that. Because one of the things you and I had talked about when we were on the phone prior to this podcast is reporting and how reporting changes according to your audience. But I think with that, it's almost anticipating who's reading the information and what questions they're going to have from their own perspective. Because an underwriter is going to have different questions compared to the chief claims officer might have different questions. So let's talk a little bit about that. Like, how do you go about presenting something to, say, an underwriting team that's different compared to a roundtable of like peers or other adjusters or counsel who evaluate claims in a similar eye as you do?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's a great question. Really, when we're discussing things within the claims team and the legal framework, there's a lot of ensuring that the due diligence was done on every issue and really kind of going through a checklist, almost like you would when you're taking a deposition of somebody, and making sure that you hit every topic that you need to hit and get on the record. When we're roundtabling a claim and it's just claims people or attorneys that are in the room, we'll go down every aspect of liability and damages, applicable joint and several law, what kind of comparative or contributory negligence we're talking about in the jurisdiction, who exactly the plaintiff's attorney is, what the venue is, who the judge is. We will go extremely granular in terms of ensuring that we've addressed all these things with the goal of distilling it down to an evaluation on the exposure to the policy and to the insured. Once we have confirmed that we have that down and that we know what the key drivers were towards generating that exposure, what the key drivers were towards creating the risk that hit that insurance policy, then we're in a better position to have a talk with underwriting where we may go more into the business side of what's the relationship with this account? What have they done over the years to address this type of risk? Is there loss control involved? Is this a trend? Is this a national trend? Is this a trend on this account? Is it a regional trend? What drove the loss? What were the key aspects of our claims team deciding that it was an exposure and how we got to our number? But it's not necessary to give them everything that we went over necessarily, because it may not have been important at the end of the day who the judge was on the case. But we did have to do that from a due diligence perspective and look at that. But ultimately, we may have decided that regardless of whether we had the best judge or the worst judge, we'd be settling this claim for the same value that we are today, because that was not something that really drove the exposure. And look, this is something that I think I like getting my team in as many of these meetings as possible, just to see the questions that are asked by other business partners. Again, either external or internal, we work with reinsurers. Reinsurers have different questions than underwriters, who have different questions than actuaries. And seeing these questions is what allows you to anticipate them later, because they are naturally going to be the types of questions that you're not thinking of necessarily as a claims handler or an attorney. That you're more focused on what your role is and the information that's important to you, but you do have to take that step back and say, okay, well, here are the questions that ultimately the business wants answered, and try and approach it from that perspective.
So let's backpedal a little bit, because you know, me as a defense counsel, I want to know how I can write a report that is going to best serve the reader, right? Because you don't want to be the one that misses the mark, because that makes you look inadequate, or you know, like you're not anticipating. But in your role, like say you have a claim, you're on the excess layer. What are you looking for? Like, what are the highlights that you're looking for when you're getting a report over from your defense counsel, whether it's an excess claim compared to if it's a first party claim? Because you're looking at it with a different eye, right? So I'm curious to see what highlights that are important to you.
So the first thing, Megan, is I think this is underappreciated by a lot of firms and a lot of attorneys, especially young attorneys. The best marketing that you can do is effective reporting. And I think the best part of it for the firm is it's actually something that you can bill for and make money while you're doing it. But having effective litigation reports, this is, in the insurance defense industry, ultimately that is the product in a way that you're delivering. You can email over all the deposition transcripts in the world, and you can send over the excellent discovery demands that you made and the responses you got, and you can send the underlying information, which that is critical to do at times too. We have claims where I want my claim handlers to be looking at the source material and getting their own impressions of what did the plaintiff sound like in their deposition, and what are they going to come across as, and doing their own independent interpretation. I think that's important for the industry to have defense attorneys and claim handlers both giving their own impression on what's happening, because they have different expertise and they have different views on it. But at the end of the day, the reporting, and as close as defense counsel is to the case, they're always going to be closer than the claims handler, because they're speaking with their client, they owe different obligations to their client, and they're in court, they're watching plaintiff's attorney, they're watching the judge, they're at every deposition, getting the feel for the room. And that story can be told through the litigation report. And that report is really a key work product and a key first impression or second impression or third impression of your firm and the work you're doing. And it can get you clients. We have firms that we've worked with because we were excess and we saw the work they were doing and the excellent reporting that they were doing on files for carriers beneath us. And we've gotten in touch with them and added them to our panel and done future work with them. So it's really a great opportunity for insurance defense firms to show what they're doing in the most positive light. And so, yeah, I mean, I think just to go back to some of the topics we were just hitting on, first of all, knowing your audience. When you're talking about excess carriers getting involved, it's a broader audience. It's also an audience that could have multiple carriers involved, especially on some of these programs. Some of the higher risk programs are going to have lower limits, lower in the excess tower. So you might have $1 million policy, followed by a $2 million policy, followed by another $2 million policy, followed by a $5 million policy. So your first $10 million, you've got four adjusters that you're reporting to. Start to factor in just turnover in the industry, different practices at different carriers. You may have claims handlers that are switching mid-claim, especially if a claim is taking 2 to 4 years to resolve, which, again, that's more likely if you're talking about a claim that's going to resolve in the excess layer. Those claims usually have a longer shelf life because the plaintiff's attorney, their demands may be beyond the insurance tower, that they may be beyond where the reasonable settlement range is. And so the case is not resolvable within the first 12, 18 months of litigation. And so, first of all, there's a lot of backstory to be told as you get these adjusters up to speed. And second, I think there's a lot of kind of between the lines that can be that can be highlighted. And it can be highlighted in a way that gets a message through in the right way, that this is a claim to pay attention to. Mm-hmm. This is a claim to escalate. It's not enough to have a conclusion, I think, at the end that says here's a value on it. I think the report has to be consistent with itself in terms of this is what we're seeing, like this is the case, and it should have a message up front, and it should be consistent throughout, because inconsistency or maybe even just sections of the report that were not updated, maybe the executive summary and the conclusion were updated, but there are conclusions within a deposition summary that were not updated that are contradictory to now what we think of the case. That type of inconsistency within a report in and of itself can lead to questions and delay and distrust of the reporting and can inhibit resolution of a claim. So I think it's important to look at this as not a litigation requirement imposed by carriers that's extraneous to the quote unquote real work in the courtroom or in the deposition, but it's as important as anything else that's being done by the firm to ensure that the decision makers at both the client, the insured, and the carrier are fully apprised of what's happening on a case.
Sometimes I feel that what gets lost in the mix of like in lawyering is people get so focused on the discovery requests and the responses and motions that people sometimes fail to take a step back and like looking at it as a whole, be like, okay, what is really happening here? And what is the big picture really look like? Like, look, we've served this discovery, got these responses, we know the damages are this, we know this is this, but like, okay, but let's just talk about this plaintiff and what happened in this instance and like, how likable is this plaintiff? Is there something problematic with the insured or the contractor or whatever it may be that despite all this paper going back and forth or these motions, these things are going to be an issue. And what I feel like is that's kind of what you're talking about too, is like pulling the pieces together that you're not just saying, oh, she had this amount of damages, putting all the black and white out there, but being like, this is the big picture of what's happening and kind of spelling it out and connecting the dots. So someone else doesn't have to come to that conclusion on their own. And as you said, like have it be consistent with what pulling it, like if you're summarizing the deposition, okay, this happened here and this goes along with her unlikability or dislikability or whatever it may be. So you're pulling the pieces together for your reader.
Yeah. And I mean, look, I understand there are some carriers, especially when you get to high volume and like personal lines, that have very strict formats of what they want. And they are really trying to get very straightforward information on certain aspects of cases because of the volume that they're not looking for. They want efficiency. They want the report to look exactly a certain way. But I think when it comes to more complex claims, more just commercial general liability, standard insurance defense, where you're working for different types of corporations, contractors, et cetera, realize that these reports are shared internally. And sometimes it makes sense to just keep that basic fact pattern at the beginning, because you don't know who's picking up that report, who doesn't even know the case yet. Or the adjuster may want to forward the report to a new manager or a new decision maker in the company. It makes it so much easier to say, it's something I have to explain over and over here. You need the basic facts. People need to know what the claim is. And to have that succinct statement of here's what happened and definitions of here's who we are and how we played into it, that can go a very long way towards making a report from something that feels useless or kind of a burden to read and pick through to, okay, those two or three sentences gave me the context I needed to at least start to dig into this. And especially if you, as defense counsel, know this is what you need to know about the case. If you're not gonna know anything else, is that you need to know this. This is the key reason why our insured is gonna be liable for this case. That it's gotta be delivered up front, because you're shooting yourself in the foot a little bit by burying that on page 4 or 5 or leaving it out, because no, this report is just about these two depositions that went well for us. It's got to be led with and it's got to be reiterated. Again, especially where I see it a lot is where there's an excess carrier in between us and primary, and there's been turnover and there's somebody new on the claim and things need to move. And a lot of times claims handlers can kind of take that on themselves and through a phone call say, hey, look, let's schedule 30 minutes and I'll get you up to speed on what you need to know about this. And that kind of personal connection can work to do that. But it really is effective if it's supported by strong reporting, especially within a single report. I think that is something that can go a long way towards a file, kind of greasing the wheels towards resolution and making a file move quicker.
Well, and also, I mean, from the attorney's standpoint too, there's attorney's turnover as well. So I mean, Like, I remember so many times having to pick up a file that someone else had, and the first thing you do is look at the reports. You're going to look at the reports, like, okay, this is what's going on. You might not necessarily take everything on as 100% truth. You might want to review everything yourself, but at least it's a first step. You're like, okay, this is what's happened. These are our evaluations thus far. Do I agree with them? Is there a change? But it at least gets you started in the right spot.
Yeah, it's the same on our end too. The report is not the be all end all. It's not all that is required to evaluate the claim, value the claim, make a recommendation on the claim, but it gives you the context and it's a great starting point towards then reviewing the rest of the file, especially if you have those key facts, key players in mind. They're going to stick out to you as you go through the rest of the file. And so again, that's just, it's a way that it can really, when done properly, expedite things. Because again, if defense counsel sends over 10 depositions and they get dropped into a folder in the claim file, and there's a new adjuster on the file, and they've got to decide, am I going to spend my time going through this? If there's a litigation report that's not really making it clear who the key people are, then it can be a more daunting task. And it could be a task that may have to be spread out across a couple of days because they might need to go through all those. But if it's clear that these are the three that we're relying on to really determine liability, then those can be prioritized. And maybe those will be enough to at least escalate a claim to another level and get it on a list and get it moving towards something, because now that's been properly escalated from defense counsel to adjuster.
Do you think, and this is just something I sometimes think about, do you find that sometimes counsel is hesitant to report 100% what they're thinking because they're worried about giving bad news? Because I get the impression that a lot of attorneys are like, oh, like they always want it to sound good and they don't want to deliver bad news. And it's doing them a disservice by kind of like trying to be like, oh no, but it's fine. It's fine. It'll be fine. Rather than being like, oh, this is a problem. And yeah, this is the problem we're going to have to deal with. But is that some impression that you might get, that sometimes attorneys are like worried about like being the bearer of bad news, and that is ultimately going to shoot them in the foot?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a natural instinct. It also has to do with, and I think this is something that's important to do, is to get to know all the handlers that you're reporting to at the excess level too. Even if they're not paying your bills, they're not the ones who retained you necessarily, but develop a relationship and a rapport with them to the extent that you understand not only what they're looking for, but they can understand in terms of what you're strengthening on the case, what you're looking at as the pros and cons on the case. And also, to your point, I think that can assist in making the attorney more comfortable in being candid in a report. I think one thing I've seen in reporting that is frustrating is going through in detail affirmative defenses or alternative defenses that really are going to be useless at the end of the day. Again, it's from a due diligence perspective. Some carriers may want it. They want to see it. It may be from a firm perspective. You want to show, we want to document that we made these arguments and that these were defenses to this claim. But instead of putting a paragraph with the case law and the reasons why and the factual analysis why that affirmative defense is not going to apply, it may be just enough to say, we asserted this affirmative defense. We no longer think it's really going to be effective or factor into the ultimate decision by a jury on this claim. And just leave it at that, because that might invite a follow-up question where you need to show your work, essentially. But it may not. It may be just enough to, and it may avoid, again, another deep dive. There could be something innocently written in that kind of factual analysis of, well, we don't think it's going to apply because of this fact. And then that fact gets disproven later. And now it's revisiting of that. And maybe that becomes a valid defense, but maybe there were other reasons why that defense was not valid, through case law development or just the judge in the case not taking that seriously as a legal defense. Again, it's kind of knowing your audience and knowing what they're going to grab onto. If you see somebody grabbing onto something that you know as counsel is worthless, it's kind of in your interest to intercept that before it goes too far down the line. And I'm sure that anybody who's worked as defense counsel, and yourself included, that's listening to this, will probably know that there are times where decision makers on cases get their favorite fact or their favorite defense that they grab onto long after it's become disproven or or pointless. And the worst is when you're having that discussion still at the 11th hour before settlement. Yeah. And you're still trying to nail down, well, why didn't this work? Or why didn't this carry? Why are we paying more than them? It's better to make sure that those kind of questions are out of the way, I think, early.
Yeah. Also, just with the like affirmative defenses, like a lot of times too, like you assert all the affirmative defenses to just in case, you know, and usually only a few are your real defenses, you know, and then as facts come along, it's be like, okay, well, they testified to X, so this is going to hurt this defense because why? And just spelling that out there is important to have in there, but like, you know, might not need, like, as you said, you might not need a regurgitation. And that's what I was going to get to next is one thing that comes up a lot is case law. And I think it's something that I see more with junior attorneys that they want to like give all this case law, but it's nothing specific. It's like definitions or general definitions of what negligence is and like just more broader identification of case law. And to me, I'm like, I don't put case law in reports unless it's some defining case that I think is something that would hurt us or we're going to rely upon and I'm explaining why. I personally don't think I need to spell out X, Y, and Z, but you might have a differing opinion on that because other people might be reading the report and maybe you want things to be spelled out. But I tend to think like, unless it's something that we are going to rely on this case because it's important, I don't think that the general stuff needs to be in there.
No, I agree with you. I think there are types of lawsuits that it's important to put that in there. One that's coming immediately to mind is negligent security, which is a hot topic in real estate, habitational law. Obviously, there with crimes occurring on properties and landlords being held liable for that.
Yeah, a little bit. It's obscure. Yeah,
well, it's a niche area.
Yeah,
it's also something that's difficult, I think, to understand from a common sense perspective. Sometimes it's, well, there's a criminal who committed a crime on a property, and the landlord's trying to be held liable for it. Exactly how that can occur, and how the case law has developed to allow that to occur, sure, is a key aspect to kind of explaining liability exposure on a case like that. But yeah, if you've got a trip and fall on somebody's property, I don't think it's as important to go through the history of general negligence from England, no, from the 1600s. So coverage too is something, I mean, look, we work with a lot of coverage attorneys, and as a carrier, we want to know what are the big coverage cases for this area? What is driving this interpretation of an insurance policy? But no, I agree with you. I think part of it is, as you know, as I know, as somebody who's been to law school doesn't necessarily teach you many practical skills at all, including, and being at a law firm doesn't necessarily teach you corporate skills. And a lot of what litigation reporting is it's not legal work as much as it's business work. It's getting information to decision makers in a corporation. And so I think that if you're a young associate and you're tasked with doing a litigation report, you think, well, I'm a lawyer and lawyers cite case law, so I'm going to do that in this document. So I'm doing legal work, but you're not doing legal work. What you're doing is conveying to your client and to their insurance carrier what is going on in the litigation. And you don't have to do it in layman's terms. I mean, you don't have to dumb it all the way down to the point that a five-year-old could understand it, but at the same time, you don't need to demonstrate. We have hired your firm because of your expertise and because of the work that you do. So unless specifically requested, I don't think it's really necessary to really do that application. I think it's more important to make sure that you're getting across what the key drivers are towards what you believe the resolution will be of the case, and then where those could change, what's coming up, what is still to occur. You know what I don't see a lot, and I think would be helpful in a lot of these reports, is examples of, well, if it plays out this way, it would go better for us. If it plays out this way, it would go worse for us. That kind of simple analysis can show your thinking of, like, here's what I'm looking for from these three depositions that are upcoming, is that if we can establish this fact or we can lock down this issue, we really do have a good chance. And that's a lot different of a message than these three depositions. I'm well prepared for them. I don't think they're going to go bad. I don't think they're going to go good. But ultimately, I don't think they're really going to change the case.
Yeah.
That's a different message than, no, these are key depositions coming up. And what comes out of them is going to really, it's going to make or break the case for us. Because that could be a signal to an adjuster that, hey, maybe we should mediate before those depositions. Maybe I have the most leverage that I'm going to have right now. And this goes to another thing that I wanted to mention before, which is that it's timing and calendar dates. These are things that are constantly being communicated and asked for between defense counsel and the carrier. The carrier wants to know when cases are going to go to trial. We're not always as equipped as a law firm for what court calendars look like in terms of there's control dates, there's trial dates, there's pretrial dates. They mean completely different things in every jurisdiction. A law firm is way more equipped because they're usually practicing locally. So they're kind of set up for what their courts look like. If we're the carrier and we're trying to track a trial date, it's not really distinguishable whether that trial date is very real or not so real. So with that comes kind of like, it's great to put in the litigation, the discovery order, and the dates that are in it, but it's more important to give your advice on what those dates actually mean. Okay, the court ordered mediation by this date. Does that mean they're going to order another one before trial? Or does that mean you probably should be ready to mediate by that date because that's going to be the one and only chance? And also based on what you know about plaintiff's counsel too, does he work or she work his cases towards the discovery order? Or are they somebody who's going to throw that discovery order out and ask for a new one in a year? That's important stuff to know.
Yeah, it's so true, though, because I work in PA, New Jersey, and those jurisdictions are so dissimilar as to how the courts operate. Sometimes it takes me even a moment to be like, okay, we're here. Now this is how this works. You know, you really have to be the person on the ground to spell it out and not assume. And you have to know that your carrier has matters all over the country, so you can't expect them to know the nuances of each individual court. Like that's what we're here for, right? I mean, we're here for a number of things, but that's one of them.
Yeah. And I mean, look, it's especially with some of the verdicts we've seen across the country, when you're working on excess files and we want to know when the trial is, because it's more unpredictable than ever what's going to happen, even if it's a control date or a date that may not be picked, but oh, the judge cleared their calendar because all of a sudden they care about this case for X, Y, or Z reason. It's good to have that date out there earlier and explain that this is how it may go, but if there's a chance it's going to go, that message has to be out there. There's a lot of procedures and processes the carriers have in place now as these trial dates are coming up that require internal work. And especially if you're getting somebody on board, if the broker just tendered to the excess carrier and trials in 60 days, that's something to make sure that you follow up with the broker and get that adjuster's information. And that's the first thing in bold in the email to them. We're going to trial. I've seen the emails. I know there are attorneys who do this. I've seen them, and it's message received loud and clear.
Yeah. Well, especially with that, you don't want to leave anything up to interpretation. You want everyone to know, like, okay, this is not a drill. This is where we're going. And we're almost out of time, but I feel like man, Tim, we had so much to talk about. I think I might need to put you down for a part two because I'm like looking at my notes over here. I'm like, oh, we barely scratched the surface. I think what I'm gleaning the most, though, from our talk to right now is the importance of reporting. Part of it lies in the attorney talking to that particular adjuster as to internally what they need to make things run easier and smoother for them on their back end, right? And in their back office. And like, it's having that conversation, be like, okay, look, what do you need? Or how do you want this put out to you to help you and make your life easier? And I think that's a conversation that needs to happen and continually happen. Like, okay, George, we're here. It looks like we might be heading to trial in like 4 months or 6 months. What do you need from me on my end to make you to be able to put your ducks in a row so we're ready for that?
And I think what I'd say to that is like, obviously, there are a lot of longstanding relationships in this industry. I'm sure that a lot of attorneys and adjusters who have worked together for years have that dynamic down, and maybe it can get routine or casual and lost in the sense of when somebody new steps into the claim. I would also advise that as counsel, especially if you're working with somebody that you're used to working with, take a step back sometimes. And if it's a primary carrier, if you think this is an excess case, make sure that it's not just you and the adjuster handling it like it's a case that's going to settle. You might want to deliver that result for them, especially if you still have a chance to do it. But really, you know that this attorney's not going to take that $1 million limit, and I'm going to have to be in touch with an excess adjuster at some point. I think it's better for that person to be invited to all the calls, do them formally. I mean, if the adjuster calls you off the cuff and says, hey, I want to talk about the case, you could talk about it, but say, you know, maybe we should schedule a call with the excess adjuster too and see if we can get them in here so that they're filled in on what you're thinking and what the strategy that you're trying to implement is, because everybody here wants to get this case done for $750,000, but it's probably going to take some money from the excess policy. And so let's make sure that we're not dictating that claim for that person, that we're allowing them to get involved and start vocalizing what they need to the extent they're going to need to get that extra money to get it done.
And like sometimes so, it's like a conversation you have with your, like it might be a phone conversation with your adjuster. You're like, look, this is what it's looking like. How do you need me to send that information to you in writing? How do you want me to translate it over so it can help you? Because, you know, there's nuances on both ends, right? And like there's nuances in how you can write it to your adjuster so they can pass it along and let excess know that they put them on notice. But you want to be on the same page. Be like, what will help you here? Like, what is the best way that I deliver this news or deliver this information? And what kind of platter do you want it to be on? And that goes, again, with the relationship piece. Like, yeah, knowing what they need and to make their lives easier and just having a conversation about it.
Yeah. And like I said, I think that's why I think this area of our industry should be viewed as an opportunity to connect with people and show what your firm is capable of in the best way possible to gain new clients and gain new business. I think it's more effective than any CLE a firm can come in and do. If I see a litigation report that clearly shows an attorney that knows what they're doing and it has control of a case and has the case set up for the best possible result, it's impressive. And it's concise, and it's kind of its own marketing statement in a way. So
that is the best type of marketing, is
seeing
your work.
Yeah, that delivering results results is the best marketing you can do.
Yes. Before we close up, I usually end these podcasts with some like little softball-ish question. And I don't want to stop it here, but knowing what you like know now, what advice would you give your younger self?
That's a softball question. Yeah. I was expecting,
it's lighter.
What's your favorite ice cream?
Like, oh, well, we could do that too.
No, it's cookies and cream, but
cake batter here. I love cake batter ice cream.
Yeah, that's a good one too. What advice would I give my younger self? I mean, I guess just to talk to people either at your office or in your industry that maybe you wouldn't expect that you need to talk to, in terms of getting an appreciation. Like if you're an associate at a firm, talk to the partner that you don't work for that does a completely different line of business and try and get an understanding of that. Don't look at your role as, no, I'm supposed to specialize and do this and master what my managing partner wants me to do. I think it's helpful. I think you hear it a lot. You talk to younger attorneys, they know the different lines of business that their firm has, but oh no, I don't know anything about that. That world is crazy. That guy he's a mad genius who does the first party property. You know, like I don't understand anything about that. I think that there's a lot to learn in this industry, and it can be surprising what can come in handy or what contacts can come in handy to pick up the phone and call when you come across an issue. So it's, I guess, just that kind of general networking of like, don't decide that as a claims person that what the actuaries do are crazy science to you. Find out what they do and talk to them, and that will help you do your job better in the long run.
Yeah, that's really good advice. I think we all could do a little more of that, of trying to understand, because everything all works together. So it will help you along the way if you understand how all the pieces are kind of fitting into the puzzle.
Exactly.
Well, Tim, I can't thank you enough. And I kind of mean it. I think I need, like, I think I got, I don't know. I think I got to point two on this, on my bulleted list over here. So I think we might need to pull you back into part two down the line. But thank you so much for joining me today on Claims Never Sleep. You're one of, as I said, one of our inaugural guests on this podcast. So, you know, thank you for taking the time to sit down and talk to me and share. I appreciate it very much.
Absolutely, Megan. Thanks for having me.
And of course, for our listeners out there, if you like what you hear, please like and subscribe to Claims Never Rest. You can find us on Apple Podcasts as well as any of your favorite podcast streaming services. And please like and subscribe, since we're new. The more subscribers and followers we get, the more exposure we get. So thank you so much for tuning in.
This is the Claims Never Sleep Podcast. presented by Cruiser Mitchell, with your host, Megan Henry.